the people, a lot of them, than there were in Waitsfield. I know a lot of the people that lived in Warren at that time used to feel that the people in Waitsfield felt above them. I think there was more money in the town of Waitsfield. I think there were Walter Jones, of course, ran the store, and he had help, and people worked for him, and the Moriartys ran the mill, and they were you know, a very nice family, very respectable family, and all that, and they would be hiring help, local help in Waitsfield to run their businesses in Waitsfield. And they didn't get those transients that Warren got. And then you speak about Moortown. Probably the Ward Lumber Company made a bigger change in Moortown, because they were, the Ward Lumber Company was a rich company, and they hired help, and it was just a different kind of help. It was local help in Moortown that the Ward Lumber Company hired, and I believe that answers your question somewhat about the difference in the towns, and I know that in Fayston was in my day was considered. Of course, that's where Ward Lumber Company got a lot of their timber, was out of Fayston. And the people of Fayston were different than the people of Waitsfield and Moortown, the local people. I think they were mostly a poorer people, poorer families than they were in Waitsfield and in Moortown. And so
that's interesting. Now, did the Fayston people, they were mostly farmers and loggers? Or?
Yes, the people in Fayston were mostly loggers and farmers, because I don't think at that time there was any stores in Fayston. They probably had a town clerk's office and a few things like that. But Fayston is so spread out, you see, that you have North Fayston and Center Fayston and South Fayston. And they were so spread out more than the other towns were.
Yeah. One of the people that I talked with was saying that I think her father had gone to farming in Moortown rather than gotten involved in working in the mills, and she was glad of that because her family were more self-sufficient, and that you tended in Moortown to work in the mills, and then you spent your money right there. And
right.
So you told me to turn it off.
I did.
Okay, let's go back a hair about the lumber. People were working and then paying for their goods in the store.
Yes, the people of Moortown who worked for the Ward Lumber Company were required to get there to do their shopping in the Ward store. Their food and their everything, just about everything that they had to do with their clothing and all that. And I had heard that if they didn't do that, then they were out of a job. And and Ralph Wimble is one example, and I talked with him, and he said that he was very glad to get to stop work for Ward Lumber Company and buy a farm and go on his own and live as he saw fit, you know. And I remember talking with this man that took me up to those shindigs up to Montpelier. What was his name? Anyway, I can't speak the name of the family right now. the lady that used to work in the telephone office in Waitsfield married one of those.
Alger.
Newton. The Newton family. That's what I'm. The Newtons had several boys. I guess six or seven. I don't know about girls, but Mr. Newton, who moved to Florida and got his and got a job down there, is a quite a musician. And after I, he plays the banjo. And after I had my heart attack, I heard that he was going to Montpelier one day a week, and that they were some musicians were gathering up there, and some of the quite a lot of the older people around Montpelier were coming in there to dance, and they would play for these people. Musicians would play for an hour or so, and people would dance to their music, and he was one of them, and he invited me to go out, and I went out and went up by the orchestra and sang several pieces with him. I wasn't able to do much else. I was just recuperating from the heart attack then, and Mr. Newton told me that he, at a very young age, he left his mother. In Moortown. She was a widow at the time, and he said he hated to do that. He really broke his heart to leave his mother alone. But he said, I could see that I didn't have any future in Moortown. And he said, I just took off and made my life elsewhere and helped my mother financially, which I couldn't have done if I'd stayed in Moortown.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's what I'm, I guess I'm hearing, is that although there were steady wages, you just couldn't get ahead.
No.
You just
no, they felt, all of the, I think all of these people felt that you just couldn't get ahead working here. And as far as that goes, I'm not sure that people in Warren felt that they were getting ahead terrifically at that period of time, but they were more independent. They weren't dependent on the Ward Lumber Company, you see. They were more independent, and they could do what they wanted to. They weren't getting rich, but they could do what they saw fit.
Well, now the hold, the Ward hold on the town has stopped now, has it not?
Yes,
much?
Yes. The ward hold on the town of Moortown is more or less, you know, stopped. I think it stopped about the time that Merlin died, because they were getting rid of their timber in those days, and and they were getting rid of their timber land and the mills. They were getting rid of the mills. They still have one mill here, but it's not. They saw clapboards out, and Merlin's son runs this mill down here, but they really aren't doing very much. They only employ three or four people, something like that.
But at the height, they must have employed...
Oh, my gosh. At the height of their business, they had three mills here, you see, and they probably employed, I would say, 75 people or maybe more. You see, because they had to have cutters in the woods, and they had to have people getting out those logs with horses, and people trucking the logs to the mill and all that. And besides the mill help in the three mills and the store help, they even ran the post office. The Ward Lumber Company ran the post office at that time. Another thing about these older people, like my parents and people of that age, they didn't believe in an education. They didn't think that an education was necessary at all for people. If you could go out and do a day's work with your hands and you were honest and all that, that was all that was necessary. The education part didn't... Not everybody in that age felt that way about it, because you see, Fremont Lovett would have never been able to do the things he did and go through college and all that if his parents hadn't supported him, you see. But
well, now, it also seems like the Wallace boys got a pretty good education.
Yes, the Wallace boys got an education. Their father was, you might call him an educated man. So the Wallaces, they did. They went to high school, and of course the high school was right there in Waitsfield near them, but that didn't always matter, you know, how close you were to the school. If you didn't believe in an education, if your parents didn't, well, you were just going an uphill grade trying to get one.
How did you come to believe in an education when your parents didn't?
I can't explain that to you. I can't explain why I wanted an education. I think probably a lot of it had to do with the fact that I was the youngest in the family. The sister next to me had died, the one that was 3 years older than I, and the others, of course, were all older. So when I grew up practically alone. You see, my sister Thelma was about 7 years older than I was, and she, of course, a girl being a girl, and the next one, Eva, was a girl, and girls have a different way of playing, a different attitude about things than boys do. In other words, I wanted to play baseball. I heard about my brothers. My two older brothers talked about playing baseball and all that, and it sort of got in my blood, and I wanted to do it. But there was no one in my school to play with. In that little East Warren school, there were four boys, but they were all, those four boys were 4 years younger than I was. And so I really didn't have a chance to play baseball or do those kind of things at all. And most of my early life was spent working, you might say. If I wanted to play, I had to, or I did, yoke up some of my father's heifer calves that he was raising and played that way. And played with them, but I didn't have anyone to play with, and I wanted to get out amongst people, and when I went to high school, I was very conscious of my attitudes and my dress and how I looked and everything, for fear that I wouldn't measure up to the people in Waitsfield. And the kids in Waitsfield, and the ones that were at my age, and I started into play baseball, and of course I didn't know a thing about it, and I don't know if I told about Henry Irish, but talking to me like he did, but I was trying to play baseball on a 4-H team, and of course I didn't know anything about catching fly balls at that time, and a fly ball came out to me, and it just went 6 or 8 feet over my head. I misjudged it, and Mr. Henry Irish was coming along, walking along, and the Irishes always went to all the baseball games, and when he saw me do that, he was right even with me, and he said, "You goddamn fool," because he didn't know me, you see, at the time. I guess probably he might have known who I was, but the people up in that part of the town were not very well acquainted with the people up in my part of the town. He was in the west part, I was in the east part. And he said, "You goddamn fool. You don't know nothing, do you? You can't play ball, you goddamn fool." I didn't get mad at him, and I'm sure that afterwards he thought about that. I know I did lots of time, but I never said anything because I went to the Irish home lots and lots of times with Ed and Klessen to spend the weekend and so on. But I can't say why I wanted an education. I know why I wanted to go to college, because I was going with Catherine Newcomb, and it was decided that she would go to UVM because she was second highest in her class, so she would have her tuition paid. And I never thought of going to college until I found out that she was going, but I wanted to have as good an education. I wanted to be equal with her because I thought that someday I would wanted to marry her, and even then I thought about it. And so that was one reason why I wanted to go to college. Another was that I just felt that people who had an education, what little I had been out, I could see that people who had an education had the advantage over the ones that didn't. I mean, my father was a wonderful man, but he could only sign his name. He couldn't read or write. And I just wanted to be a little bit different, I guess.
I drove by, I guess it was the farmhouse you grew up in, and now there's a lake.
Mm-hmm.
Was it boggy there before, or was there a pond there, or...?
No, there wasn't any pond where Blueberry Lake is now. That was there was a brook that ran down through that meadow, and that meadow near the brook was quite level, and so that was all marshy. And a lot of that meadow we couldn't get on with the horses. And when they came to put that dam in Blueberry Lake, they found that they could, I heard my father say that in certain places there that they could run a rake handle down the whole length of it, which would be 6 feet, just through this muck-like stuff before they would strike hardpan. And so we couldn't get the horses out on those pieces, and we mowed them by hand and tumbled that green hay up and carried it out of there on our backs and spread it out on the higher land to dry. And that's the way we hayed those places.
And so is that house that's there now, that was the house you grew up in?
Yes, that was the house I was born in and grew up there. And all my brothers and sisters were born there and grew up there.
And there must have been more barns.
Yes, the barn has been torn down and all that. And it's a queer thing. I have dreams a lot of the time, and I never dream about, hardly ever dream about this farm or the farm that I was on in East Warren, but it's always that farm where I was born and grew up, about the difficulties that were there and how to overcome those difficulties. I'm dreaming about those things. And I dream about my father, and I can see him doing this and that, and my mother, and us working around there. But a lot of it is how to overcome some of the difficulties that we had at that time.
Someone told me the story about your sister, Dawn, and how she also told me that...
My sister who?
That died.
Oh, yes, that died. Myrtle.
Myrtle, mm-hmm. She also said that your mother kept a calendar for years and years and years after that. Myrtle, I guess, had taken a pencil.
You're right. Right.
Literally, was it?
Drew down across that calendar and stopped on the date that she died. The end of the thing. There's some very queer things that go on if we just think about them once in a while. And that little girl clim up there and drew that line down and stopped on the date that she died.
In fact, it was, I think the way Thelma told it, was the date she got sick to the date she died.
Yes, I believe it was. I'm not quite clear on that, but I think the line went from the day she got sick until the day she died.
And was it a burst appendix?
Yes, a burst appendix.
A lot of people.
And you didn't know, people didn't know. I just am so curious why that I lived all these years that I have when I had that same thing. No, I didn't have the burst appendix, but I came very close to it, and I had appendix trouble from the time I was 11 or 12 years old until I got so that I could go out and work and earn my own money, and then I went and was operated on. I think that people thought about what they needed to do and getting the living. I know that, and here's quite a story, that we had all that piping in that sugar place, and we set up 2,800 with that piping, 2,800 taps. And as my father got older, he wasn't able to do as much work. Of course, he was 60 years old, I believe, when I was born. And so that he and Raymond didn't have the wood sawed. They usually had Ernest Brooks come with his power, with his horsepower and drag saw rig to saw those logs, and then they would split the wood and put it in the sugar house and have it dry for sugaring. But the logs got down there, but they didn't get sawed and split. And my mother, of course, was a workhorse, and at that time I was having a month off in sugaring. The schools closed for a month so the boys could help sugar. And I went home to help sugar, and here was this big pile of logs there and 2,800 taps and hardly any wood in the woodshed to go on. So my mother and I took the pair of horses and the sled and dray and would go up there by that wood pile, and she would pull on one end of that crosscut saw, and I did on the other, and we would saw the blocks off of the big logs, and then I would split them with wedges and a hammer. And I remember very clearly that this appendicitis attacks would take me then, when I was splitting that wood. And my mother would say, "Well, just sit down a few minutes, Robert. You're going to be all right." And I would sit down and rest a few minutes and go back at it. And so that's the way we sugared that year, was my mother and I getting that wood and putting it down to the shed so my father and my brother could boil.
And you were how old?
I was 16 at that time. I was 16 then when I was doing all that. And appendicitis was bothering me, and it did a lot after that. So that's why I say it. I don't understand why I'm still alive, why I didn't go the same way my sister went, but I was tough.
Yeah, I guess David DeFriest had a burst appendix.
Yeah.
Almost killed him. No joke.
My doctor that I had in Montpelier didn't get all of my appendix when he operated. There was a little piece left. And I don't know how many years after that it was. Must have been 5 years later. I started to go deer hunting, and my side began to bother me again. And, of course, I didn't have any idea what it was. And a man that came to hunt deer with me said, "You're going to the hospital tonight. I'm taking you to the hospital to find out what that is." So, and the doctors didn't have any idea what it was. So, but I was in so much pain that they did an exploratory operation and found this little piece of appendix that was left, and it was all gangrene-like and ready to break.
You are like you, charmed life. That's what I meant. Yeah. Uh-huh. Incredible. Were there people in East Warren that could that had second sight, that could look into the future, or that read your palms? Some of the little communities in Vermont had a person like that, like Luvia LaFerriere in Marshfield.
Well, now that you ask about that, excuse me, I think that my mother was blessed somewhat that way. I remember that when Dennis went to Montpelier to work for Light and Power Company. Of course, he didn't have any more time to for his trap line that he'd been running, but I suspected he still wanted to keep in it somewhat, so he set some traps for me. And this was when I was, both years when I was in the 7th and 8th grade. And I know that, of course, I was real anxious to catch a fox and all that. Being a kid, you know, it meant a few dollars to me. And each day, each morning, my mother would have her tea, and then she would dump her, she made it so that the tea grounds came in the tea cup. And she would drink her tea and then pour off the last of it and turn her cup over, and I believe she would put it in the saucer and turn it around three times or something like that. I can't. And here this morning she picked up this cup back up and she says, oh, you're going to get a fox this morning, and he's on the side hill. He's up on a side hill. I can see the side hill, and you have a fox there. And so, boy, I tore out of that house, and I went to look at that trap, and sure enough, I had a fox. Now, that could have been just a coincidence, I'm not sure, but she was always reading tea leaves and coming up with things that were going to happen. Quite often, you would connect that with something that would happen.
How'd she learn to read tea leaves?
I haven't any idea how she learned to do it. She never said.
Because I think that was considered a real art and a gift. Can you remember any other things that she told about?
I guess that was the one that really stuck in my mind more, but I realized that she was always doing that. She was always reading tea leaves, and we used to laugh, we kids used to laugh about at her sometimes, but...
Would people come in and have her...
No, it never, just the family would...
Did she ever predict somebody's death, or...
I'm not sure whether she did or not. You see, my mother's father was an Indian, and I'm not sure how much of an Indian, but he was born on an Indian reservation, at least, and I guess that she never wanted to talk about that, that she was an Indian. So I'm sure that some of these things, some of these ideas that she had, were something like the Indians. You know, you inherit things like that, and you certainly do. Some people believe that they can take a child from any kind of a family and raise them to be real smart people and real honest people, but that's not so. That's not so, because we saw instances in East Warren where people had adopted children and did the best they could to raise them, and they were nothing like they thought they were going. Of course, that could happen to your own family, too. Like, I know that some of my brothers and sisters took back, as they call it, took back from ancestors and were more like them. Did I tell you the story about the woman that wanted implants?
No.
And she told her husband that she wanted implants. And he said, I don't know what you want to fool around with that for. He says, they suit me fine. But she kept at him, and she was going to have implants. And finally it came to him, this idea came to him, and he says, I got an idea. He says, three or four times a day, why don't you... wad up some toilet paper and rub it up and down between your breasts. She says, what the hell good is that going to do? Well, he says, it might not do any good, but it did wonders for your hind end.
Oh, gosh. I was
heard about this other man that came home intoxicated at night, and his wife was mad, of course, and she locked the door on him. And when he came to the door, she wouldn't let him in, and he kept rapping and knocking at the door, and finally she came back to the door, and she says, "Well," says, "I'm going to let you in, but there's only two things, there's only two reasons why I'm going to let you in this house tonight." And he says, "I know it, darling, I've got one, and you've got the other." Oh, Marion, can you get us a sandwich? This lady wants. Ernie Whistle came to work for my people, and he married one of my mother's nieces, Almy, and he came and he made up this little song, and he said, "I came to Warren looking mighty green, hired out to Almond Gove for to drive his team. He said, 'Can you drive a pair of mules, do you think?' I said, 'Give me what you call the rawhide whip.' Went down the road to get a load of hay. Said, 'Young man, don't you let them get away.' I cracked my whip and the leaders sprung, and they bid farewell to the wagon and tongue." My hands and arms would go in time with my singing, and... yeah, that was a common thing.
Were there any particular songs for Mullen? Or would you sing, I mean, there must have been songs that, you know, that had the right rhythm.
Yeah, there was, but I, you know, it's been so long.